I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There are some 500 public schools that offer single-sex education, and that's a significant increase in the last decade. They're built around the idea that boys and girls had different styles of learning. A recent paper in the journal Science attacks single-sex education in an article titled "The Pseudoscience of Single-Sex Schooling." It said the research was, quote, weak, cherry-picked, or misconstrued, and may do more harm than good. It's our topic for today's Radio Times, Who is Right? Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Leonard Sachs. He's a psychologist, a family physician, author of Why Gender Matters, Boys Adrift, and Girls on the Edge. He's also founder and executive director of the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education. And Leonard Sachs, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And on the telephone is one of the authors of that article that appeared in the journal Science. Janet Hyde is a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she's a founding member and board member of the American Council of Coeducational Schooling. And Janet Hyde, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm happy to be here.
I'm going to put a couple of questions to you, Leonard Sachs, and then Janet Hyde, I'll put a couple of questions to you. But Leonard, this is an issue that you have been supportive of for a number of years now. What are the benefits of single-sex education?
Well, I think it depends on who we're talking about. Our association and I personally have never suggested that every child or even most children should be in single-sex schools. As I wrote in my first article on this topic back in June of 2002, we're not suggesting every child should be in a single-sex classroom. We're suggesting every parent should have a choice. Many kids do fine in co-ed schools. I myself attended only co-ed schools in Ohio, K through 12. But you will find some kids, and I saw this in my own practice as a medical doctor, some kids who are bored and disengaged in the co-ed setting, and you move that boy to the boys' school, and suddenly he's engaged and motivated. And a girl who's all focused on whether Justin likes Emily in the co-ed school, put her in the co-ed school, and suddenly she's more focused. Not every child, not most kids, but some kids benefit. We live in a sexist society, a society that says that keeping a journal, writing poetry, that's for girls. That's uncool for boys. So what boys need in order to write poetry and find their voice is different from what many girls need.
Let me quote something that you wrote. Girls thrive in non-competitive, collaborative learning situations. Boys are motivated more effectively by competitive environments with clearly defined winners and losers. Talking about essentially some of the differences between boys and girls and their learning styles. Have you changed
yes,
your position
I have.
On that?
I wrote that a long time ago. In 2008, I retired from medical practice. I was a full-time family doctor, and that means 70 to 80 hours a week seeing patients and writing these things late at night. Retired from medical practice in 2008 to devote myself full-time to visiting schools and learning everything I can. And my views certainly have evolved since then. I have now visited more than 300 schools, and I've learned that girls are intensely competitive, and you can use that. Boys can be amazingly collaborative, and you can use that. Actual differences between girls and boys are very small, but girls and boys tend to exaggerate those differences in the co-ed setting. In the single-sex setting, if teachers have some training, you can break down those stereotypes, and you can have boys who love to collaborate and girls who love to compete.
One more question, and then I will get to you, Janet. But are you saying then that from your perspective as it stands today, that parents and children should have a choice when
exactly.
It comes to public school?
Exactly. I had the privilege 2 months ago of leading a two-day workshop for the Barack Obama Leadership Academy. That's a brand-new boys' public school, not a charter school, launched by Dallas Public Schools. They had more than 600 families apply for spaces, not only from across the city of Dallas, but from Plano, Richardson, Mesquite, some of the affluent suburbs. They were only able to accept 240. So we've got a lot of families out there who think this might be the right format for their child. We're not saying every child or most children. We're just saying, why not let those parents have a choice?
Well, Janet Hyde, let me get you into the conversation. And as I said, you're one of the authors of this recent paper, The Pseudoscience of Single-Sex Schooling. What is the pseudoscience you're referring to?
Well, the justification in Leonard's books and some other books as well relies really on cherry-picked science, finding isolated studies and not really looking at the overall picture of the science. Several governments across several nations, including the U.S., Australia, and Britain, have conducted surveys of the available research that scientifically evaluates the effects of single-sex schooling compared with co-educational schooling, and they find no academic benefits to single-sex schooling. There's really just no evidence for that, despite the fact that people may have intuitions about it. But really, the evidence doesn't indicate that there are academic benefits.
Are you saying, though, that single-sex schools are harmful to children, or just that they haven't proved to be beneficial to children?
We can think about different outcomes. Academically, there are no benefits. If we talk about other outcomes, like increasing gender stereotyping, then there's every reason to think that separating kids by gender, which makes gender very salient, will increase gender stereotyping. And that's not something we want to do. We want to bring boys and girls together to work together productively. The adult world is coeducational, and we should be training children to function well in that circumstance.
In fact, in the study, you say that there is some research that shows that boys together become more aggressive. What is that based on?
If you get a high concentration, well, we have numerous studies that show that. If you put a high concentration of boys in a room, especially an all-boys school classroom, then, in fact, the boys are more aggressive than they would be in a coeducational classroom. And I know that Leonard loves anecdotes, so I was actually in a single-sex middle school, 7th and 8th graders, last week observing single-sex boys, all boys classes, all girls classes, and co-ed classes. And the extent of poking and prodding and distraction of boys by other boys in the all-boys classroom was just amazing. And the teachers said that, in fact, the all-boys classroom is the most difficult one to manage. So it really seems amazing to me that someone would intentionally set up classrooms of that sort.
Well, let me give Leonard Sachs a chance to respond to that, Janet. Leonard, go ahead.
Yes, I invited Janet to attend our conference this last weekend, our 7th International Conference, where she could have had the opportunity to hear from teachers who have seen a dramatic reduction in discipline referrals in the all-boys setting. Simply putting boys in a room without girls accomplishes nothing good and often leads to just the sort of situation that Janet just described. Many years ago, I was visiting a classroom and saw just what Janet just described. A teacher ran out of that classroom in the second week of class and had said, "Who came up with this stupid idea of putting all the boys in a room without girls? Craziest thing I ever heard of. They're stabbing each other with pencils. We got to have the girls in the room to civilize the boys." So this is one of several major misconceptions in the article Janet wrote, namely the notion that simply putting boys in a room without girls accomplishes anything good. It doesn't. It creates an opportunity, though, to do things differently. You can deploy strategies in the single-sex setting, which you cannot deploy in the co-ed setting. Teachers have some training in those strategies, which is what our conference is all about. Then you see that discipline referrals go down. Without that training, discipline referrals go up.
Janet Hyde, go ahead.
Yeah, I need to point out that the teachers in these classrooms that I was observing had been trained by you, Leonard. And, in fact, they had sentences memorized from your books. So I think that they've had the kind of training that you're talking about. And they're very enthusiastic about single-sex schooling. But nonetheless, you could observe what was happening in the classrooms. But I want to go back to a couple of things that Leonard said early in his comments. One is his argument that every parent should have a choice to send their child to single-sex schools. And I just want to think about that a little more deeply, because superficially it sounds good, but I think it doesn't bear up to deep scrutiny. So let's imagine, for example, that I'm a white parent and I have my white child, and I believe that I should have an option. I should have the choice to send my child to an all-white classroom. I don't want my white child in a room with some brown and black kids. Does that argument about choice extend there? I don't think that we would accept that argument about choice. So why is it a requirement that parents should have a choice for single-sex schooling? We would never accept that for single-race schooling. So I really think this choice argument does not bear up to close scrutiny.
Janet, hold on to that thought, because let me ask you something. And I noticed this in the article that you co-authored. You don't use the phrase single-sex education or single-sex schooling. You talk about sex-segregated education. Are you saying that single-sex schools are a form of segregation the way we had racial segregation in the past?
Well, if you look up the definition of segregation in the dictionary, yes, it does exist, because segregation refers to separating different groups, you know, across space, and that's what you're doing. You're segregating boys and girls if you go to single-sex classrooms. Yes, it's segregation, and it's just the kind of segregation that used to be done by race. And actually, the gender segregation used to be done in the 1800s in the United States, so it's odd to be calling it an innovative educational strategy now, where actually it's a return to the 1800s.
Well, Janet, hold on, because I know you want to say more, but I've got to give Leonard Sachs a chance to weigh in. Go ahead.
Yes, Janet has just given us a legal opinion. She said it's segregation, just the kind of segregation we used to have with regard to race. That's a legal opinion which has been considered by the United States Supreme Court and lower courts, and they have rejected it. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 1996 explicitly said the analogy between race and sex is not valid, that race is a proscribed and forbidden category, but sex is not. She said, and I quote, "Differences between the sexes are cause for celebration," end quote. She said it is perfectly constitutional and appropriate for states to offer single-sex public schools, provided that comparable courses, services, and facilities are made available to both sexes. Earlier this year, in June, the federal court in Western Kentucky, in a case brought by the ACLU against Breckenridge Public Schools, the ACLU attorneys had said this is sex-segregated education. The judge dismissed their complaint, and he said, "I feel compelled to address the inflammatory language in the plaintiff's briefs referring to single-sex classes as segregation." He said that is not accurate as a matter of fact or law. Segregation in the United States means involuntary. There was nothing voluntary, Brown, about Jim Crow segregation. Those black parents did not have a choice. But the judge continued, "The school district here is giving parents a choice. Giving parents a choice is not segregation." He said the plaintiff's use of that term is simply an attempt to impose a unconstitutional tinge to this district's innovative efforts.
So Janet, we have to take a very short break, and I want to give you a chance to respond to what Leonard Sachs just said. But let me just, in the meantime, reintroduce both of our guests, and we are talking about the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of single-sex education. And that issue has been reignited by a recent paper, The Pseudoscience of Single-Sex Schooling. It appeared in the September 22nd issue of Science Magazine. One of the authors of that study, Janet High, joining us by telephone. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, also a founding member and board member of the American Council of Co-Educational Schooling. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Leonard Sachs. He's a psychologist, a family physician. He's written three books, Why Gender Matters, Boys Adrift, and Girls on the Edge. He's the founder and executive director of the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Where do you come down on this issue? Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Camp Hill Special School with day and residential options is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe developmental disabilities. Camp Hill's curriculum includes music, art, drama, the sciences, life and social skills development, animal husbandry, and horticulture. Hosting an open house at their Chester County campus on October 15th. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're in the first day of the fall membership campaign at WHYY, and we need and want your support. Make a pledge right now at 1-888-345-9499. Think of what you get when you listen to Radio Times. In this hour, we're debating single-sex education, an issue that's been in the news. We keep you informed and entertained weekday mornings and evenings on Radio Times. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art supports WHYY, presenting Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus, the first exhibition in Philadelphia ever to include the rare painting, prints, and portraits of Rembrandt, the great painter of the Dutch Golden Age. Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus reassembles a group of more than 50 intimate portraits of Christ that have not been seen together since they left the artist's home in Amsterdam more than 350 years ago, on view through October 30th only. More information at philamuseum.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Janet Hyde and Leonard Sachs about the pros and cons of single-sex education. We have one open line at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to move on and talk about strategies and research, but Janet Hyde, I do want to give you a chance to respond to what Leonard Sachs was saying before the break, which is that racial segregation was in a sense mandatory, whereas what he's talking about is choice. Go ahead.
Right. Well, he took us off in a different direction very cleverly. But what I had asked is, if I'm a white parent, I have a white child, do I have a right to choice for my child to attend an all-white school or an all-white classroom? I'm phrasing that as a matter of choice. Is that a matter of choice? I don't think so. I don't think that we would tolerate that. So my question is, why would we tolerate that for gender? But let me also get back to his comment about choice, and parents should have this choice.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Sachs said early on the program that it depends on the kids. Some kids will benefit from single sex, and others won't. In fact, he said not most kids, so the majority of kids wouldn't benefit. So that means that school districts that set up two-thirds of their classrooms for single sex are actually way overestimating the number who would benefit. But let's assume for the moment that there is this small number of children who would benefit. How are we going to know who those kids are? I wonder if Leonard has devised a scale that parents can administer to their kids. I think we just have to probe more deeply about this. How do we know who these kids are who would benefit?
Well, it's a good question. I'm tossing it to Leonard Sachs. Go ahead.
Certainly. And last year I wrote a scholarly paper addressing indeed one aspect of this issue. My paper was entitled Sex Differences in Hearing, Implications for the Classroom. I shared four scholarly objective studies showing that for the average boy, you need to speak about 8 decibels more loudly compared to the average girl. Dr. Hyde and her colleagues like to cite some blog postings by Mark Lieberman at the University of Pennsylvania, which rely entirely on subjective questionnaires. But when you look objectively, you find for the average boy, you need to speak more loudly. That's not true of every boy, however. So in the paper...
So should they be given hearing tests?
Indeed. Stevens N, which is the parameter that converts the subjective experience of sound from the objective amplitude of the stimulus, typically has a value of about 0.30 at 60 decibels for females.
I don't know what that means.
Well, what I argue in the paper is that if you measure this parameter and you find that this boy has a value of Stevens N above 0.30 at 60 decibels, then he would not do well in a boys' school. That's a testable hypothesis. Maybe it's true, maybe it's false, but it is susceptible to empirical test. The authors of this paper, including Dr. Hyde, believe we have sufficient evidence based primarily on research done in co-ed pre-kindergartens in Tempe, Arizona. They assert that boys who are with other boys become more aggressive. They provide only one citation to support that assertion in their paper, and that is a study of 28 mostly middle-class, mostly white boys. It's reference 27. Mostly middle-class, mostly white boys at a school in Tempe, Arizona. What I would conclude from that finding is that you want to be cautious about enrolling your son in that pre-kindergarten in Tempe, Arizona. In the all-boys setting, we can deploy different strategies so that boys behave like gentlemen and are not stabbing each other with pencils.
And let me just follow up on that, and I'll get you back in, Janet. But are you saying then in a classroom of boys, and are we assuming that the teacher is a male as well?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
Okay. No, we do not find that men are more effective than women. The key is for these teachers to be trained in these gender-specific mm-hmm. strategies that can make that boys' classroom orderly and well-governed.
And the idea is speaking louder to boys?
About 8 decibels more loudly. That's about 2.5 clicks on your volume dial. And again, in my paper, Sex Differences in Hearing, mm-hmm. You'll see the scholarly work on which that recommendation is based. These are objective studies, not questionnaires of the sort that Mark Lieberman relies on.
Well, Janet, let me go back to you. I mean, if there is research, as Leonard Sachs says, that shows that for some children there are some of these sex differences, if that could be proved, would you be more supportive of the idea of a single-sex school or classroom?
Even then, and by the way, I have to ask Leonard where your paper was published that you're referring to?
Advances in Gender and Education. You can pull it up online at no charge, full text.
Is that a peer-reviewed scientific journal?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. I'll have a look at it. I actually am pretty cynical about whether these differences in hearing exist.
I hope you'll read the paper that Professor Ken Norwich at the University of Toronto wrote on this topic, as well as his colleagues, Sandra Sagi.
Okay, go ahead, Janet.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have great confidence in the University of Pennsylvania Professor Lieberman, who's an expert in these matters and has really been very critical. He's not a member of our group. That's an independent line of criticism. But I do think that even if there were these differences, and I don't believe they're there, but even if there were these differences, we still are going down a slippery path to say to boys and to teachers and to girls that boys and girls are so different that they cannot be educated in the same classroom. That's a very dangerous message to send to kids. And then we expect them to go into the adult world of work, and the girls are going to say, well, I deserve equal pay for equal work, but I am so different from these men that I couldn't be taught in the same classroom. We know that stereotyping increases. And again, I have an anecdote, because I know Leonard likes anecdotes. In this single-sex classroom that I was observing in last week, one of the girls in an all-girls classroom decided to confide in me, and I said, do you like the single-sex classroom? And she said, oh, yes, I like it. Boys are so obnoxious. Hmm. And when the boys are gone from the classroom, we girls can move faster. This was an algebra class. Now, that is precisely the point. We have hundreds of studies in social psychology that show that the minute you separate people in groups, even on an arbitrary basis, not something as obvious as gender, but that you start to get in-group favoritism and out-group derogation, that is, you start to think your group is wonderful and the other people are awful. And you could hear that in that little girl's comments, that the boys are just totally obnoxious and that the girls are superior and can go faster. So that's the kind of thing we worry about. With the Arizona State
program. You know, Janet, let me just stop you there, because are you saying, and it sounds like, having read your paper, that you are saying that the some 500 either public schools or classes within public schools should not be funded by public education? Is that what you're saying?
I should be clear that I'm talking purely about public schools. Private school, you know, if the Jesuits want to have an all-boys school, that's their business. I'm talking about public schools funded by taxpayer dollars, and I can't think of any good reasons why you would want to do that, and I can think of some reasons why you would not want to have those single-sex schools and classrooms.
But I'm wondering, and even beyond Leonard Sachs, but if a parent and they're choosing as they know their child, and they know the way their child has learned up to, let's say, till they enter first grade or kindergarten, if they believe that their child would do better in a single sex school and they don't have the money to send them to a private or parochial school, they shouldn't have that choice.
By the way, not all private schools are single sex.
No, of course not.
Again, I'll ask you, if I'm a white parent and I want my white child to be in an all-white classroom, should I have that choice?
But you're saying that if I send my child to a single-sex school, that I'm saying something about the other sex?
I'm saying that your child will implicitly, because there has to be a rationale for these single-sex schools, right? And the rationale is that boys and girls are very different. They don't get along well in the classroom. In fact, what we ought to be doing is bringing them together and teaching them how to interact well and productively in the classroom. So we're sending a message to kids by saying, gosh, I don't think you're going to function well in a classroom with boys for this little girl. So I think it's not a message that I would want to send.
Well, let me give Leonard Sachs a chance to respond to that.
We just heard Janet say that, and I'm quoting, separating kids by gender makes gender more salient. Well, that's actually a testable hypothesis, which has been tested in shown to be false. For example, Ursula Kessels and Bettina Havanover randomly assigned 401 teenagers either to be in a co-ed classroom for physics instruction or a single-sex classroom, randomly assigned them, and they found at the end of the year that the girls who were randomly assigned to the all-girls setting were more confident about their ability to learn physics, were less likely to agree with the statement that physics is for boys, were more engaged in the study of physics, whereas girls in the co-ed setting were more likely to endorse those gender stereotypes. So contrary to Janet's assumption, separating kids by gender makes gender less salient. Girls act more girly when there are boys around. Likewise, a recent study published earlier this year in the journal Sex Roles, Corinna Titsa and her colleagues looked at girls at girls' schools compared to girls in the same neighborhood attending coeducational schools at eighth grade, found no difference between the girls in their ability to do spatial rotation. But at 12th grade, they found that the girls at the girls' schools had made great gains in spatial rotation ability, no gains at all for the girls at the co-ed school, again refuting Dr. Hyde's basic assumption that single-sex schools makes gender more salient. In fact, single-sex schools makes gender less salient.
Can we agree? And I know we could go have dueling studies, and I appreciate that, and I know a lot of this this disagreement is based on studies that have come to different conclusions. But Janet, and to you, Leonard, as well, can we agree that whatever happens in a classroom, that the teacher in many ways creates the environment for learning, whether it's a co-ed classroom or a single-sex classroom? Janet, would you agree? That's not the most brilliant thing I've ever said, but would you agree with that?
The thing that makes the biggest difference is the teacher, and the single-sex configuration has little to do with success or failure.
Would you, and from your perspective, Lynn?
The single-sex setting is not a good idea if the teacher has not had appropriate training. In fact, it can be a recipe for disaster.
Because the teacher can buy into these some of these
things. We live in a sexist society, and what you end up with is very much what authors of this paper describe in their co-ed pre-K. When you make gender salient, for example, that study in the co-ed pre-kindergarten in Arizona, they had pink bulletin boards for girls and blue bulletin boards for boys. Well, that's a really bad thing to do, and we know that. So the single-sex setting creates an opportunity to do things differently, but if teachers don't have any training, it can, in fact, reinforce gender stereotypes.
Well, that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times, single-sex education, the pros and the cons. Leonard Sachs and Janet Hyde, our guests. And we have a full bank of calls here at 1-888-477-9499. Where do you come down on this issue? And perhaps you have some experiences from education you'd like to share as well. 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Jill from Glenside to join our conversation. And Jill, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
I'm
calling. I went to a co-ed school from grade school, you know, from kindergarten up through eighth grade. And then for high school, I began at a co-ed school for 2 years. And then I chose that I wanted to go to an all-girls school for 2 years, to finish my junior and senior year of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, when I switched to the all-girls school, I really thrived. So my grades improved. And not just academically did I thrive. I thrived in all aspects. And so my question is, does it matter? And when I was in grade school as well, I did very well. It just seemed that I struggled at that age when I was, transitioning into adolescence.
The high school years.
My question is, does it matter what age? You touched on it a little bit, but I was curious about that. And then a follow-up to that would be...
If you don't mind, only because what you put out there is a really important question, and I want to give it the time that it deserves. But let me get quickly a response from you, Janet Hyde, which is Jill's choosing in high school and feeling that her choice was the right one for her. I'd be curious about your response.
Well, right, when we make choices, I'm glad to hear this anecdote, from one person, because that's a real lived experience. And, of course, when we make choices, our psychological mechanisms, it probably did work well for her. I have to say that I went all the way through a co-educational high school, and I loved it and felt that I thrived in it. So, different people have different stories to tell. The point is, when you look at the science, over many, many people, you don't see advantages to single sex.
And to you, Leonard, she wonders, is there an appropriate age for a a child or a family to think about?
Well, sure, and it varies from one child to the next. And I can also share stories of boys in my own practice who, in first grade, decide they hate school. School's a stupid waste of time. Schools are run by women for girls. And you put that boy in an all-boys setting, and you see a tremendous change. In fact, our co-founder, Janet Phillips, had just that experience with her son, Andrew, switching him from a co-ed private school to a boys' private school in first grade. It completely changed his attitude. He's since graduated from a boys' high school, went on to Stanford, obviously a co-ed school, did very well, and graduated from that school. But, you know, right now, this is not an academic parlor debate. Right now in Madison, Wisconsin, a group of African-American teachers and administrators are trying to open a boys' public charter school led by Kayleen Carré. And Janet Hyde is personally trying to prevent that from happening. She spoke at their hearing 1 week ago to say, no, parents in Madison should not have this choice. Nobody in Madison should have the opportunity for their son to go to a boys' public charter school.
Go ahead, Janet.
Well, that's actually, you were not there, and that's not a correct quotation. I actually said, I'm not trying to stop the charter school from going forward. I said I supported the idea of the charter school. I objected to one feature of it, the boys only feature, and that I thought that they could create an extremely effective charter school that was coeducational. So I don't know where you got your information or whether you're purposely lying, but that's not what I said.
Well, go ahead, Lenny.
Kayleen Carré, the founder and leader of that organization, has told me, Janet, he believes that this school needs to be a boys' school, and you have said that it can't go forward as a boys' school.
Well, first of all, I don't have any power in the decision. I was just testifying to the school board. He has a right to his beliefs, but the scientific data simply don't show that single-sex configuration will add anything. I know that's his dream, but we have an example in Wisconsin of Rufus King High School in Milwaukee that caters to an equally lower-income clientele of ethnic minority students. It's extremely successful. They use an international baccalaureate program, and it's coeducational. That's the punchline. You can model yourself on Urban Prep in Chicago, which is an all-boys school, and they have had some successes, but they have poured enormous resources into that school, which I support completely. And it's totally unclear that any of the success has to do with a single-sex configuration. The success has to do with all the resources, the good teachers and so on, that they put into that school.
Leonard, something that Janet has said, and of course when you talk about single-sex education, this always comes up because we live in a co-ed mm-hmm. world. How does a single-sex school prepare a child for the world of co-living, co-working?
Absolutely. And I myself made that comment to one of my patients, Pam Yost, many years ago, when she was telling me how her son had gone from being a lackluster and unmotivated student at the co-ed private school to being engaged and motivated at the boys' private school. I said, Mrs. Yost, this is the modern world. Men and women have to work together. School should prepare kids for the modern world. I said, with all due respect, I regard single-sex education as an antiquated relic of the Victorian era. And she said, Dr. Sachs, have you ever been in a boys' school? I said, no. Why would I be in a boys' school? I attended only co-ed schools. She said, Dr. Sachs, with all due respect, you have no idea what you're talking about. Why don't you visit a boys' school? So I did. Went to visit a boys' school, third grade classroom. All the boys were jumping up and down to spell the word abbreviate. And after the boys left, I said to the teacher, I said, where are the chairs? Why are there no chairs in the classroom? And the teacher said, well, everybody knows when an 8-year-old boy sits down, his brain shuts off. I said, well, excuse me, I don't know that. I'm not aware of any scholarly research to support that assertion. But in her defense, within that insular community, it is well known. What 8-year-old boys need is different from what adults need. The best classroom for an 8-year-old is not the same classroom as what's ideal for an adult.
And I still want to find out how single-sex schools prepares for the co-ed world. That's Leonard Sachs joining us along with Janet Hyde. We are talking about the pros and cons of single-sex education, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation works to advance economic opportunity in southeastern Pennsylvania. It supports nonprofits that develop workplace skills, teach financial literacy, help new arrivals, and sustain those undergoing tough times. The Foundation can help you make a difference for such nonprofits today and forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We're in the first day of the fall membership campaign at WHYY, and we need and want your support. Make a pledge right now at 1-888-345-9499. Think of what you get when you listen to Radio Times. In this hour, we're debating single-sex education, an issue that's been in the news. We keep you informed and entertained weekday mornings and evenings on Radio Times. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Germantown Academy in Fort Washington supports WHYY with over 250 years of history and innovation. GA provides a foundation for students to become independent, confident, creative, compassionate, and honorable. Offering a pre-K through 12th grade co-ed curriculum, GA proudly introduces their new middle and upper school buildings, nature preserve, and athletic fields. An open house will take place on Wednesday, October 20th at 8:30 a.m. Details at germantownacademy.net.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Janet Hyde. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She's a founding member and board member of the American Council of Coeducational Schooling. And she's also one of the authors of a recent paper that was published in Science Magazine titled The Pseudoscience of Single-Sex Schooling. Also with us is Leonard Sachs. He's a psychologist and a family physician. He's written three books, Why Gender Matters, Boys Adrift, and Girls on the Edge. And he's the founder and executive director of the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education. Just a quick response, if you don't mind, Leonard, which is, you know, how do these single-sex schools, though, prepare a child for the world of co-ed? Not co-ed, but just co-living.
That's right. The comment I made to Pam Yost when I said, look, the real world is co-ed. School should prepare kids for the real world. Therefore, school should be co-ed. Based on a false assumption. It's based on the assumption that the co-ed school resembles the real world. It doesn't. The co-ed school is a very peculiar world in which all your classmates are within 1 year of your birthday, no one's married, and everyone's a potential romantic partner. That's very different from the real world of the workplace where people might be 20 years older, 20 years younger, and few of them are romantic partners. But ask, who are some women who've pioneered, who've done things no woman's ever done before in this country, who've broken into previously male-dominated areas, like Dr. Madeleine Albright, first woman Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, first woman National Security Advisor, Bernadine Healy, first woman to lead the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Drew Gilpin Faust, the first woman president of Harvard, Dr. Sally Ride, okay, the first American woman to fly in space. They all pioneered. What do they all have in common? They're all graduates of girls' high schools. Dr. Ride says in her autobiography, she never considered being an astronaut. That was for boys. Until she went to a girls' school and she discovered, hey, I love this and I'm good at it. And after 4 years at the girls' school, she could go on to the co-ed college and the co-ed postdoctoral program, and it did not intimidate her. She had found her voice. Girls at girls' schools find their voice. Girls at co-ed schools often don't.
What do you think, Janet Hyde? Then we will get back to our callers.
Well, I don't seem to have lost my voice having gone to co-ed high school, and actually I attended the first coeducational college in the United States, Oberlin College, which has been a coeducational since 1837 and has turned out all kinds of outstanding women and men. But, Marty, I hate to raise this, but I think it's an important thing for viewers to consider, and that's the issue of conflict of interest. So Dr. Sachs and I have different positions on this. My income comes from the University of Wisconsin. I'm a faculty member here. And I don't stand to benefit financially one way or the other in how this debate turns out. I'm just trying to say what the science says. Dr. Sachs, as far as I can say and see, and he may correct me, I may be wrong about this, but it looks to me like he earns a living going around promoting single-sex schooling, which in turn, I would think, creates a conflict of interest for him in making these pronouncements. So I would just like to hear Dr. Sachs's response to that.
Go ahead, Leonard Sachs, very briefly, if you don't mind, then we'll get Sanjeev to join us.
Yes, indeed. I took a big cut in income leaving medical practice to devote myself to this topic. And believe me, if it was about earning money, I would still be practicing medicine. This has been a very unwise move on my part as far as making money is concerned. You know, this is a common response, kind of a desperate last maneuver that the critics will use when teachers and principals at boys' schools and girls' schools will share their experience. They'll say, well, you work at a girls' school, you work at a boys' school, therefore you are disqualified because you have an incentive. Only people who don't work at girls' schools and boys' schools, and only people who have no connection to girls' schools or boys' schools, are qualified to speak on this topic. I say, you know, let's stay away from the personal attacks and let's focus on the issue of whether parents should have a choice in public schools if they don't have $20,000 or $30,000 a year to send their kids to a private school.
Let me get Sanjeev, who's been waiting very patiently from Winmore. Sanjeev, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I am the parent of two young girls, 7 and 8 year old girls that are in second and third grade in a fabulous school district, in the Springfield Township School District. And but in the past, they've been homeschooled for a year. Well, I say it's homeschooled, but they've also gone to a private school, a really great school at Norwood. What is disturbing me with some of the dialogue that's going back and forth here is, as a taxpayer, I feel like Janet's comments are completely dishonoring of parents who are taxpayers being given the choice. See, I'm not hearing Dr. Sachs, if I've got the names right, Dr. Sachs talk about how everyone should be forced to do this. There should not be choice. There seems to be an honoring of parents knowing what it is that might be best for their child, and as taxpayers being given the opportunity to choose. And then I hear all the scientific evidence that supports a point of view. And what's disappointing here is, Janet, I keep hearing you dismissing the evidence that there might actually be some benefit. And I also hear a dismissing of parents actually being able to be intelligent enough to be able to know their children better than anybody else and to be given choice.
Well, Sanjeev,
and that's what's really disheartening.
I hear you. And let me give Janet Hyde a chance to respond to your comments. Sanjeev, thanks for the call. And Janet, go ahead.
Well, first of all, the scientific evidence overwhelmingly shows no academic benefits to single-sex schooling, so we just have to get that out on the table. It's not that it's worse, sometimes it's worse than co-ed, but it pretty much is a tie with co-ed. So people who think they're going to get benefits from single-sex schooling for their kids, that's just not what the data show. I don't respect parents. I'm a parent myself, you know, and I've made some choices about my own children's schooling. But I just wonder what the limits are of choice. We're claiming choice for single-sex schooling, but where does that stop? Do I have a right to choose not to have any special needs kids in my child's classroom and so on? So I worry about the continued segmenting of the student body that's occurring with special schools. I think that some parents probably would have a pretty good sense of what would be best for their kids, but it might be along lines other than gender, and then would we want to support that?
Well, let me give, and I know we keep coming back to this
repeatedly
issue.
Janet Hyde has asserted that the data don't support academic benefits. Her assertion is false. So, for example, in her science paper, she cited a British study which found that for one particular subset of men over 40 years of age, they had a higher divorce rate. They highlighted that finding and only that finding. They neglected to mention that that same British study found that girls who attended girls' schools were much more likely subsequently to earn college degrees in math and science, that boys who attended boys' schools were much more likely subsequently to earn college degrees in foreign languages and literature. That study concluded, and I quote, gender stereotypes are exacerbated in co-ed schools, and I quote, gender stereotypes are moderated in single-sex schooling. The divorce finding referred only to boys who graduated from the lower tier of British schools, not the upper tier, and I have have attended and visited those schools, the upper-tier schools like the City of London School for Boys, which have lots of co-curricular activities with girls' schools. The lower tier do not. So what I learned from that study is that a boys' school should not be a monastery. It needs to have lots of co-curricular activities with their partner school, the girls' school. Talk about cherry-picking. These authors of this study have taken that practice of cherry-picking one finding from this study and neglecting the entire rest of the study, which found many benefits of attending a girls' school or a boys' school.
Let me give you, Janet, a chance to respond to that. Then I do want to quote something else, and then we'll get back to our callers. Go ahead, Janet. He's accusing you of cherry-picking.
Well, first of all, the format for this science article limits us to 2 pages front and back, including the references. So we had many, many more references that we could have used and did not because of the space limitations. But I think we have to look at the overall government reports. But also, I mean, I'm glad that Dr. Sachs has brought up this instance of isolated cases of single-sex schools producing good results. But the catch is that the kids in these British studies, they're not randomly assigned to one school or the other, and nor are they in the United States. It has to be a matter of parental choice. So it turns out that when the kids enter the single-sex schools, they differ from the kids in the co-ed schools already. There's one study in Texas now where the kids in the single-sex girls' school had higher test scores going into the school. So when you find that they have higher test scores going out, it's not because of the single-sex configuration. Rather, it's that they were a biased sample, a privileged sample going in.
Well, and let me just quote, I apologize to our listeners to do this, but Christine Hoff Summers actually wrote a critique of your critique, Janet, but she also went on to say, and I'm just quoting here, when the Department of Education carried out a systematic review of single-sex schools in 2005, it found a muddle of contradictory results. Like much of education research, advocates on either side can find vindication if they look hard enough. The Department of Education rightly deemed the research equivocal and called for more studies. So let me just get Lizzie from, looks like Bryn Mawr, to join our conversation. And Lizzie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I attend an all-women's college currently, and I have quite a few friends who attended single-sex high schools. And that's a topic, actually, that comes up a lot in conversation because those experiences shape us so much into who we are today. And I just wanted to say, I heard Janet mention a few times that there isn't any statistical evidence that single-sex education has academic benefits, but I would argue that maybe if you can't see them statistically, there are benefits that can't be shown through statistics, such as empowerment, you know, positive self-perception, and sometimes those kinds of benefits, those personal benefits, are even more valuable than academic benefits. And, I'm coming from a place where I'm in a single-sex space, and I think single-sex spaces are actually very special because they don't have those stereotypes, those social pressures that are found in co-ed spaces. So that's a place for, at least for me personally, to develop who I am and my interests and passions beyond my gender.
Fair enough. Lizzie, thanks for the call. Janet, go ahead.
Well, I teach at the University of Wisconsin, which is co-educational. I teach a psychology of women class. And I mean, I appreciate your comments, and I know there are lots of women who've gone to women's colleges who feel that they became empowered. I felt awfully empowered at coeducational Oberlin College, but I think if you would talk to women in my psychology of women class at coeducational University of Wisconsin, they would tell you too that they felt very empowered. So I am completely behind empowering young women and young men. But it's not at all clear to me that you need a single-sex configuration or that it really contributes anything to that. I think we're doing it here well at the University of Wisconsin.
Go ahead, Leonard.
I think, Lizzie, the caller, makes a real good point that we need to look at parameters beyond grades and test scores. For example, teenage pregnancy, drug and alcohol use. Avshalom Kaspi, who was Dr. Hyde's colleague at Wisconsin before he left for Duke, he went to Dunedin, South Island of New Zealand. He found that girls attending girls' public schools were much less likely to use drugs and alcohol compared to girls from the same neighborhood who attended comparable co-ed schools No difference in family demographics could explain that. It was the school format. Girls at girls' schools are less likely to use drugs and alcohol, and that difference becomes larger with each passing year.
And that's Leonard Sachs. He is the founder and executive director of the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education. Janet Hyde joining us as well, and she's a founding member and a board member of the American Council of Co-Educational Schooling. Both of them joining us in this hour of Radio Times as we debate the pros and cons of single-sex education. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
And good morning. I'm Dave Davies here at WHYY, along with Dennis Devine, one of the producers of Radio Times, and we are coming to you for a very short break to ask you to join us in the critically important task of sustaining this program and this service, and I think you know how that's done, with a pledge of support at 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY or online at WHYY.org. Dennis, we don't take much out of this program because we know Radio Times listeners really count on it. So we ask these listeners to get to us quickly in a very short break and do what we all need to do to keep this program going strong.
Yeah, Dave, it's so important now to have the support of Radio Times listeners. We're entering our 25th year of Marty's 25th year of hosting this show, and this show is a great example of what she does so well. Host a conversation, mediate, moderate, and bring out these really contrasting opinions where folks can disagree respectfully, and we all benefit. You all benefit there listening at home in your car, in your studio, in your lab, in your workplace. And we're asking you now to follow through and support WHYY. And you can do that by calling 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. Or go online and give an online pledge at www.whyy.org.
First day of the drive, and it's really important that we get off to a good start here. It's a bit of a dreary day out there, and that reminds me of the premium that I own and really enjoy, the WHYY umbrella, which you can get for $10 a month. And the good thing about it, you think I'm going to say it's because it will demonstrate your support for the program. No, what I'm going to tell you is that umbrella is big, and your friends will love you because two others will gather under the sign of you and WHYY if you make that call and make that pledge. But, you know, Dennis, you made a point about this program. What a terrific example of what public radio does uniquely. An issue that everyone kind of is interested in, single-sex education. Two, people who know each other and don't particularly like each other's positions. These are intellectual heavyweights going at it. They are committed. They are passionate. But it is an informed, empirical debate. It is respectful. Marty keeps it on point. It is exactly not the kind of shout fest you might hear on a cable television program. You are edified. You're informed. You get that here day in, day out, week in, week out. It's worth a pledge of support, isn't it? 1-888-345-9499 or WHYY.org.
You know, we pride ourselves on how interactive the show is and growing increasingly so. And that starts with you, the folks who call in and contribute. We had some great calls this hour. You know, an issue like this, like you were saying, Dave, that hits home. You know, a lot of people have been to same-sex schools or care about education right now. And so they got dogs in the fight. They got passion and they got and you have, you know, a stake in all this. And so Marty provides you a venue to call in, talk to these sort of world-class experts on this issue to ask them what's on your mind, or share what you think about the issue at hand. And we also have a lively exchange on our Facebook page, on our Twitter account. You know, it's just we're seeking ways to reach out and allow you to get into the content of the show and the conversation. And we're asking you to also reach out to us. And